ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
From an Ipswich fish and chip shop to the epicentre of Australian politics.
Please explain.
Pauline Hanson is making its One Nation.
This is the unlikely story of One Nation.
Well, I'm back.
Is it a passing protest vote or a permanent realignment of Australian politics?
Whether you love her or hate her, truth is stranger than fiction.
The making of One Nation. To hear the full series, search for The Making of One Nation on ABC Listen.
Ahead of the budget, the main complaint about home prices was that they were too high. Now, suddenly, home prices are falling. They're down 0.4% in the month of June, and the main complaint in Parliament is that they're falling.
Does the Minister know how many first home buyers now owe more money than their home is worth?
And there's every reason to believe they'll fall further, and every reason to believe that homeowners, owner-occupiers, will buy as investors bail out.
I talked to someone last weekend who was able to be successful at an auction that previously they'd almost given up on.
Which was the idea. But what'll it do to renters, to rents, to the supply of homes, and to what used to be the great Australian certainty, that home prices always climbed and that you'd end up owning something worth more than you paid for it. Welcome to The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and our guest this week trying to make sense of what's going on in housing. Now, some of the numbers are in. Matthew Bowes, who's the housing specialist at the Grattan Institute, and Maria Iannotti, who's been examining how the places in which we live and the ways in which we live in them are changing at the University of Tasmania. Welcome, Maria, and welcome, Matthew.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, Peter.
Matthew, those figures first. National home prices, home values, because that's actually what's measured by the Catality Index, have fallen 0.4% in June after climbing for years and remaining steady in May. Now, that doesn't sound like a big drop, but it's the biggest drop in 3.5 years. Does it look like it's the start of something, in the words of Ella Fitzgerald, the start of something big?
Well, Peter, I'm not sure that we have a really good sense of what the bottom of this market dip looks like at the moment. But I think we can get a fair idea based upon what's happened in the past when we've had increasing cost of living concerns and increasing interest rates, because we had that kind of conditions just a couple of years ago post-COVID. And what we saw in that last sort of period during which house prices declined around 2022 was a dip in the order of 5 to 10% depending upon the region. Over time, at some point, the market will get back to where it was, but those kind of short-term conditions really matter in terms of the dips we see across the year.
But that's due to interest rates to a large degree. What about due to the tax changes in the budget? The Treasury forecast, its words were, home price growth of 2% less than it would have been for 2 years, which I suppose could mean home price falls of 2% more than they would have been. What does your modelling at the Grattan Institute predict for what these sort of budget changes will do just in their own right, the tax changes to home prices?
Well, you're right that these tax changes will have a pretty small impact on house prices. That's certainly what we estimate using, I think, pretty similar kinds of techniques to Treasury. And really the reason we can see that in the data is because when we look at the size of these tax concessions, they're sort of tax concessions that are worth a bit above $10 billion per year, depending upon how you measure them. If you look at the value of those concessions into the future compared to the size of the Australian property market, which is more than $11 trillion, it doesn't look like removing those concessions is going to make a big difference to investor demand. There's a lot of home buyers who want to buy a home and live in it, who will be able to replace those investors as they pull out. And so we think as a result, any price decreases will be pretty small. We've estimated in the order of 1%. Treasury's estimated in the order of 2%. But regardless, the price change we think is going to be pretty limited. And I think the fact is that when we look at where this trend in lower house prices started, it looks like it started before the budget.
There's something funny though about that. The Treasury's talking about 75,000 home buyers, owner-occupiers, buying houses that landlords would have once owned. That's quite a lot. And yet a very small price change. Treasury says 2%, you say 1%, bringing that about. How can that happen?
Well, I think this goes back to the kind of dynamics that these kinds of tax changes bring to auctions, right? So what happens is if you're an investor, you'll have some price at which you can kind of make your investment work out. And if you change the tax concessions you get at the other end, that price is probably a little bit lower than it was otherwise. You can't go that extra $25,000 that you previously could to outbid the home buyer who was looking to buy the home and live in it. So rather than the price of that home decreasing a lot, it just means that it decreases a little bit to whatever the other person would have bid.
Someone can win with just an extra dollar, really.
Exactly. It can be a pretty small change, but in terms of prices, but it can lead to that relatively large change in composition. Again, these are pretty small changes in composition when we consider the declines in home ownership we've seen over the past couple of decades, but they do go some way towards increasing home ownership rates after a long period of decline.
Small overall, Maria, but really different depending where you are. It's in Sydney, Melbourne and Canberra that prices are falling, and by quite a lot. They're not falling in the other cities on average, and they're not falling outside of the cities. What's been happening to the way our housing market works? It seems to be almost the case geographically, you can no longer talk about a housing market.
Yeah, that's right, Peter. So house prices are still growing strongly, for example, in Darwin, also followed in Perth, Hobart and Brisbane, but they seem to be at a decelerating pace. And then we have the regions, regional cities in WA, Tasmania, South Australia, Queensland, even, we saw some drops in regional Victoria and New South Wales, but the rest of the states are still growing and quite strong. So it could be the case that Sydney and Melbourne or New South Wales and Victoria more broadly are leading new types of house price dynamic. I have done some work with colleagues and we show that before the pandemic, it was the metropolitan cities that would originate a change in the house price and that would kind of ripple out to other cities. So imagine a change in Sydney having an effect on Wollongong or Newcastle. But what we saw is that after the pandemic, it was the reverse. So we were seeing changes in house prices that originated in Geelong, Ballarat or Bendigo, if you want to think of Victoria, that were spreading into Melbourne, for example.
It's like the tail wagging the dog.
Yes, exactly. A reversal in the relationship.
Well, I suppose a kind of analogy, Sydney and the bush influencing Sydney instead of the other way around as people live in more pleasant places, at least places that are easier to get around. Matt, if the government's tax changes won't dent prices much, what might? The coalition has promised to limit demand. Demand and supply give us price. That's the only graph we'll do here. You can think about it or you might have learned it in Economics 1. They want to limit demand by limiting demand from immigrants.
Tonight, I announce a far-reaching and unprecedented housing policy. A coalition will cap immigration numbers based on the number of homes constructed each year.
What do we know about population growth versus growth in the supply of houses, the number constructed? What do we see if we go back 10 years?
So I might even start a little bit earlier than that. So if you start around the kind of year 2000 and what you look at is the adult population, because what we really care about when we're talking about this underlying part of housing demand is how many adults are there who want to form their own households, you know, kids that kind of come on as an addition. If you look at the adult population compared to dwelling growth, what we see is that over the period of sort of 20 years, they've roughly evened out. Australia's probably seen its dwellings grow a little bit less than adult population. A lot of other countries have seen dwelling growth that far exceeds adult population growth. So we are a bit of an outlier in that.
What about just in the last few years, which obviously is what the opposition is concerned with?
Well, that's exactly right. So what we saw in the last few years is during the pandemic, we had a decrease in population growth. People moved out of homes that they were sort of, I guess, pushed into because of a poor affordability. So you think about a whole bunch of kids, say, living with parents who previously wouldn't have been able to move out. Suddenly they had options to move out that they wouldn't have before because there were all of these rental places that were struggling to fill themselves. Since the pandemic, that has then shifted. Obviously, we've seen a bounce back in population growth, even though population isn't far above where it would have been if we'd continued pre-pandemic trends, because you had those people move out and then demand on top of that. That's created a lot of pressure, both demand from new Australians, but also demand from existing Australians who want to buy better homes in maybe bigger homes in places that they would like to live.
Maria, housing prices took off and rents took off in 2021. Now, that's a significant year because it's a year in which we had no net immigration. That is to say, the number of people arriving because borders were closed didn't match the number of people leaving. What else was going on to cause that, on the face of it, explosion in demand for houses?
Definitely the big growth in house prices that we saw during 2020 and 2021 was not a result of migration. Our borders, international borders, were closed, and many domestic state borders were also closed. So we need to consider that households form and break in a very dynamic way. There may be children moving out. There may be partnership breaking. There may be diseases. There may be many reasons why the household size may decrease, actually, and therefore there's more households. We actually know that 70% of dwellings in Australia are old separate houses with an average of 3 bedrooms. Is that what we all need? Population growth is not the only story determining the demand for housing.
My own father, who died at the end of last year, was living in a house that used to have 5 people and was very happy. So I imagine if that is happening everywhere as we age, that would increase the demand for houses. And as you suggest, during COVID, people wanted more space. I'm wondering whether there's a broader point, Matt, that there's no such thing as demand for housing. And what I mean is, people might choose to live with their parents. Now, they're not demanding housing, perhaps because it's too expensive or whatever, but as soon as they get the opportunity to move out, they will, or people might be couch surfing. Is this whole idea, and, you know, it's implicit in the opposition leaders' talk that there's a demand for housing in that policy, is the whole idea really wrong that it's sort of, I think economists call it fungible, it's movable?
I think it's hard to say that there's no demand curve for housing. As an economist, I want to push back against that idea. But I would say that, you know, when we're thinking about demand, demand isn't just about what kinds of housing, you know, housing choices you want to make. It's also about what your ability to pay for those is, what your willingness to pay for those housing outcomes is. It's one thing to say, you know, Australia's housing stock needs to grow X percent per year or whatever it is to meet growth in population. It's another thing to say that that kind of growth will lead to homes being affordable for Australians, as Maria said, in the places that they want to live.
All of this tends to suggest that house prices might not fall much. Of course, even if they did fall 10 or so percent, it'd only take us back a year or a bit more than a year in terms of what's happened, which means our housing wealth is probably secure, even if our housing affordability is not much better. That's the way things are looking with the data we have on The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and our guest this week, housing specialists Matthew Bowes from the Grattan Institute and Maria Iannotti from the University of Tasmania. Matthew, what will the budget changes do to renters? The figures out last week showed rents climbed a bit faster after the budget in May, up 0.4%, but still over the year up a measured 3.6%, which sounds like a lot, but it's lower than the rate of inflation, which was 4%. When we look back over the longer term, what's been happening to rents? What's been happening over the past decade or more?
Yeah, I think this is an interesting story because I think it cuts against some of the narratives people have and the ways that they frame housing affordability. when we look at the kind of overall rate of rental growth as measured, as you say, by the Consumer Price Index, we can see that actually rental growth over the past 10 or so years has generally been slower than the Consumer Price Index.
So slower than inflation.
Slower than inflation. And slower than, obviously, wages as well, which is another important metric, right? So that would suggest, well, you know, why are we worrying about housing affordability for renters? I think the flip side of that is really about what the experience of renting is like. So as we were saying, when we're talking about lower income households who are really budget constrained, any sort of change in the rental experience that they have, any changes in their ability to kind of find secure places to rent in a tight rental market where vacancy rates are really low. So the number of new dwellings that are coming online for them to choose to move into or to move into if they're evicted, those kind of rate of flow of new dwellings is quite slow. That experience for those renters is still quite tricky. And so I think when we're picking up on the challenges that young people are facing with sort of renting, it's perhaps not quite so much about the price of a rental accommodation. It's really about what that rent gets you. These sort of young people, I think nowadays, particularly feel that their experience of housing compared to their friends who are able to purchase their own home and have that security, people who are able to kind of rent in places where rent growth is really low and where there's high vacancy rates, it's a renter's market, you can take your pick of the home, that they see that their experience is difficult compared to those people. So it's actually more about the quality of renting perhaps rather than the price that is challenging, I think, a lot of
people. It must be partly price shock too, because you gave the figures for the last decade, but rents scarcely moved at all in the years leading up to COVID. They were cut, thanks to landlords, cut during COVID, and we've seen quite big increases as we moved out of lockdowns. Nonetheless, rents have not increased relative to inflation over the past 10 years. Maria, what would you expect to happen to rents now as a result of the budget? I ask that because on one hand, some renters will be able to buy homes, so they will no longer be renting. That means fewer renters, I suppose, less demand. On the other, investors will sell to people who buy homes, so there'll be fewer properties available. How does it look as if these two will balance out?
We're not sure about that. There are estimates coming from Treasury about the number of new buyers, as you quoted before. I think that another concern, and Matt kind of pointed that out, is what kind of dwellings are out there for renters, because also what the new policy changes in tax is bringing is a segmentation, if you want to think, of the housing markets between what is new housing and what is existing and older housing. And it's going to be interesting to see that segmentation. We will see potentially new housing stocks and investors in the new housing market.
The government and changes do prioritise that. You still get to negative gear if you buy a newly built home.
Yes, we may see new home buyers into these existing older stock as well.
So it'll depend very much on who you are. Is it right, Matt, to think of it in theoretical terms as one for one? You've got the Treasury says its estimate is 75,000 people getting into homes as owner-occupiers, presumably 75,000 fewer rental properties as a result. You would think that that would mean, in theory, no change in rents. Demand falls, supply falls. What's wrong with that simple analysis?
So I think the biggest thing that kind of analysis misses is the impact that the change in prices, which is small, that as we've discussed, the change in prices that we'd expect to see from this policy will bring to housing supply. Because ultimately, if you're a private developer building housing, whether or not that housing will sell or rent for a good price really matters to whether or not you are going to go ahead and make that investment in new housing production. And so we do see, based upon historical evidence, but also just looking at kind of the production process for housing, when prices fall, there are somewhat fewer housing starts, which means over time less supply. And that does mean less availability of homes, both for renters and for homeowners.
So might it be the reverse, though, in this special case? case. The Treasury doesn't think so. It thinks there'll be 35,000 fewer homes built. But might it be the reverse in this special case because the tax concession is being concentrated? It's only now available, negative gearing, to people who build new houses. Is there a chance, or am I too optimistic, that we'll actually get more houses built than we would have?
I think there's a chance that we can still get better housing supply outcomes than we would have previously. But I think if that's the case, it's in part going to be because of all of the work that we've done, both at the federal level and at the state level, to remove those other major barriers to housing supply, the things that really impact the ability to kind of build homes where people want to live. And that's the things like planning barriers to building apartments and townhouses. And there is actually money in the budget for reforming those kinds of barriers at the state level, for encouraging states to do that. And also for reforming things like building codes, which make it tricky to build homes that build homes quickly, build homes productively that people need. So ultimately, I think because existing and new housing is all part of one market, trying to segment the kind of market, as Maria was talking about, in terms of having housing tax concessions that only apply for new homes, it's tricky to kind of do that when prices are going to shift for both of those at the same time. So it's, you know, remains to be seen how much impact those kind of new supply concessions have. But certainly the broader push from governments at all levels to unlock more housing, options for housing and land for housing in our cities, that will have a big impact on supply.
Might there also be another problem, Matt? The Treasury says we'll get 75,000 owner-occupiers. Owner-occupiers we wouldn't have got as they buy rental properties. Because of what you were talking about earlier with latent demand, people, you know, living with their parents or so, those 75,000 extra homeowners mightn't be people who are renting. And so it might be that we'll reduce the rental stock, reduce the number of places for rent without reducing the number of renters as much.
So that's certainly a real risk. I think, again, when we're talking about 75,000 new homeowners in the context of a pretty large housing turnover, where we're saying, in some years close to 1 million homes turnover every year, that is a pretty small impact. I think any of those kinds of compositional changes you're talking about are going to be small. But I do think that goes to the point that helping people purchase a home isn't the same thing as helping renters. If governments want to help renters, they need to be looking at what housing options are available and how they can make them better. And they also need to be looking at things like 10-year security, income support for low-income renters. All of those things are probably more important to your average renter than whether or not someone else who, you know, happens to be renting in their home, or maybe someone who happens to be living with their parent, is able to get into the housing market a little bit earlier than they
would want it. Well, the Treasury's talking about an increase in rents of $2 per week. Other people say it might be $20 per week. It's still, with all due respect to renters, and I'm one at the moment, it's still not large in the context of weekly rents. Does it sound, Maria, like a reasonable sort of trade-off that you pay a bit more in rent and you get a greater chance of leaving renting?
Yes, I think that the thing we're forgetting here as well, and making that point that Matt was thinking about landlords, we are seeing construction costs still increasing, right? In the most recent CPI release, new dwelling prices rose by 5.6% in the 12-month going. And we know that that can be, you know, a result of material costs, labor and shortage of skills, energy prices, fuel prices that have been passed on, etc. What I'm trying to think in advance is what's going to happen with rents for this new housing stock that is going to be more expensive to build as well. So maybe current rents are not a lot more expensive, but the new housing stock coming in the pipeline may not be that affordable.
So there's homes and there's homes, and the two aren't the same in a number of ways, geographically, also whether they're new or not. Very quickly to each of you, Matt first. I know Grattan has a list and I want you to go through it very quickly. What's the best way of increasing the supply of houses?
So in short, the best way to increase the supply of homes is to remove the restrictions that particularly state governments and councils have put on where we can build new apartments and new townhouses. So what we've recommended is that governments around Australia allow at least three-storey townhouses or apartments to be built on all kind of residential land.
Ordinary suburban streets that all at the moment have a freestanding house.
Exactly, exactly. And that provides sort of a release valve for demand pressure in suburbs that previously couldn't accommodate additional growth. We've also made recommendations around allowing for more apartments, higher density around public transport corridors, but, you know, in general in high demand areas. And we've also recommended that governments remove parking requirements for new homes. So removing requirements to add a certain number of parking spaces per home, which increases construction costs and doesn't actually correspond to what a lot of people are asking for in their new home today.
Maria, what would you do, or what do you see happening to increase the supply of houses? One is changing, hopefully gently, the nature of suburbs, as Matthew suggested, as well as building apartments. What do you see happening that would help?
Yeah, I think that reducing that red tape is quite important, as Matt was saying. But I'm also thinking about, we talked about regions and regions now being under pressure in terms of housing affordability, and they tend to have lower levels of stock. And also they have the challenge of scale. It's not that easy to build a high density in regional places where the scale is not there and those investments are hard to come by. So I think the best way to support housing supply is trying to make building cheaper and more affordable. And, you know, red tape plays an important role there, but also maybe we need to start bringing in this newer technology to build faster and cheaper. And I think there's a lot of barriers still in terms of standards and other regulations.
You're thinking about 3D printing, modular construction, robots, in fact, building houses.
A bit of a shock in the market, I think. And that could come from faster and cheaper building in a more affordable way. I'm not necessarily compromising quality, but in a more affordable way.
Both of you are giving me the impression that what the government has done in the scheme of things is small. It's probably moving things in the right direction. It's not going to collapse housing prices and get existing homeowners worried, nor is it going to do as much as perhaps one might hope for rents and getting people into housing. Maria and Matt, thank you. Before we go, as is traditional on the program, anything to look out for in the days and weeks ahead? Matthew?
For me, the thing I'm interested to see is some planning changes that have come in place in a place that I lived for 10 years, which is Canberra, famously a low-density city that now, from I think 1 July, is allowing townhouses to be built on basically all of its residential land. So that's a big change from 80% of the land being locked into these single detached homes. And I'll be excited to see if that has an impact on housing choices and housing supply in Canberra and whether that can be something that we take further in other states as well.
Maria?
Well, I'm looking forward to a bit of learning that I will be doing in the European Housing Research Conference in the next couple of days and then coming back home.
We should say you are in Oslo at the moment in Norway at an international housing conference.
Yes, I'm bringing that knowledge back to Australia, and I'm also looking forward to watch Messi dancing his last tango at the Soccer World Cup in the next weeks.
Maria Iannotti at the University of Tasmania, normally, and Matthew Bowes, the housing go-to person at the Grattan Institute. Thank you both so much.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you, Peter.
And thank you for listening. You can find our episodes on the ABC Listen app or on ABC Radio National Thursdays and now Saturday morning. You can email us, theeconomy.stupid@abc.net.au. Sarah in Tasmania wrote about last week's program about tax reform. She says, we all agree we need tax reform. Why does every government seem to back away at the last moment? Well, fair point, but it hasn't completely backed away. Yeah. As we've heard, thanks to producer Hayley Crane. I'm Peter Martin. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.